The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Donna Gerson. As you saw in the great video that aired earlier, the Free Library is advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity each and every day at its 56 locations throughout the city, including the new Rosenbach of the Free Library in Philadelphia. If you value this inspirational, transformative institution as much as I do, please consider making a gift to support the Free Library Foundation. The foundation helps make possible many of the library's incredible programs, like the award-winning author series that you are here to enjoy tonight. So remember, visit freelibrary.org/support to make your gift today. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's author, Marlo Thomas, as well as the woman who will be interviewing her, Tracy Matisak. An accomplished actress, author, and activist, Marlo Thomas burst onto the scene with her pioneering role as the star of television's That Girl. She has been honored with 4 Emmy Awards, the George Foster Peabody Award for Television Excellence, a Golden Globe, a Grammy, and the Ellis Island Medal of Honor for exceptional humanitarian efforts. She is also the voice of St. Jude's Hospital and has been so involved in helping children find the medical care that they need. And that is... Inducted into the Broadcasting Hall of Fame, she created Free to Be You and Me, a project that became a platinum album, best-selling book, an award-winning television musical, and a stage show. I can attest that Free to Be was a big influence in my life. I learned that it's all right to cry, that parents are people, that William should have the doll, and that Atalanta must go out into the world and see what she can see before she settles down. Those ideas were common sense, and they were revolutionary. And I thank Marlo Thomas for bringing that into my life and to the lives of so many women here. Her new book is It Ain't Over Till It's Over, a collection of empowering stories about women who have reinvented themselves in extraordinary ways. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Marlo Thomas and Tracy Matisak to the Free Library. Thank you.
Well, I better be good. That was very nice. Thank you so much.
And good evening, everyone. I'm Tracy Matisak, and it is my great pleasure and honor to welcome Marlo Thomas to the Free Library.
Thank you.
Let me just get this out of the way at the beginning. I've had the theme from That Girl in my head all week, haven't you? So let's just take care of that at the outset. Marlo, so much that we want to talk with you about, but we'll start with your new book. It ain't over till it's over. What got you to thinking about writing a book about women reinventing themselves?
Well, you know, I travel a lot for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and everywhere I go, audiences like this, many, many women are there, and they would raise their hand at the end of my speech. They'd ask a few questions about St. Jude, and then they start talking about themselves, that they felt stuck. They weren't sure what to do. They're 42 years old, and they're out of a job. They had this great dream to be a mom. But once their kids got their driver's license, they didn't really want a mom. They wanted their car. And so mom at 42 or 43 years old is out of a job. And what is she going to do next? And then there were some other women for other reasons. They got laid off from a job and they felt stuck. Or they got a divorce and they felt stuck. Or they lost their spouse and they felt stuck. And they didn't know how to start again. And it really touched me to listen to this, because I'm a woman who has stayed in my career all of my life since my 20s. And I didn't really realize how many women left the job market to do the very great job of raising a family, and then want to get back into the job market 15 years later. And the job market wasn't particularly open to them. You know, in our culture, wisdom and experience is really not valued the way it is in many European countries. We don't even keep our buildings up in this country. You know, in Europe, they keep the buildings and the people up. So women are having a hard time, you know, finding their place because they haven't gone through the whole mill the way many of their male counterparts have. And another kind of woman that I met were women who took a job because they needed to make a living. They needed to either make a living if they were single or be a part of supplementing the family income. And so the dream they had is way back there somewhere. But what they had to do was practical, which was make money. That's true for men and women. And one of the women in the book that I really responded to was a woman named Gaylee McCracken, who was a very good graphic artist, and she made a good living at that. She always wanted to go into medicine, but her father told her when she was going to college, you know, marry a doctor. What you should do is study something that you can get, you know, a job when you get out of school. And so she took the advice, and she became a graphic artist. So when she was around 38 years old, she was doing a medical brochure as an artist and doing the graphics for it. And she said to her colleague, you know, creating this medical brochure kind of opens an old wound for me. I really wanted to go into medicine, and I regret that I didn't do it. And her friend said, well, you could still do it. And she said, of course I couldn't do it. I'm 38 years old. By the time I became a doctor, I'd be 50. And her friend said, you're going to be 50 anyway. So she did. She went to medical school, and when she was 49, she became a doctor. She's now in her 60s, and she's a doctor. And she took that dream that was in the back of her head that she put away because her father was telling her to do something practical, and she's living her dream. And I just find this so inspiring. You know, I'm in my 70s. Yes, I am. And I have reinvented myself every 10 years. I've been an actress. I've been an author. I now have my own website called marlothomas.com, where I do an interview show every Monday called Mondays with Marlo. I've been on for 3 years. I have a sponsor, General Mills. I've interviewed everybody from Chelsea Clinton to Susie Orman to Dr. Oz, Anderson Cooper, Katie Couric. I mean, you name them, they've been on. Just yesterday, we had Jill Abramson, who's the executive editor of the New York Times, the first woman editor ever of the New York Times. We interviewed her. So we have all kinds of women, all kinds of men and women that I interview. I'm having a ball. I mean, you know, all of a sudden I'm Mrs. Donahue. You know what I mean? I don't have a microphone, but I've got people that I ask questions of. And the questions come from the audience. My audience types in the questions, and then my guest answers the questions that come in from the audience, which is fabulous because, for example, we'll have a sex expert like Dr. Laura Berman on. I don't know if you've ever seen her. She's been on a lot of shows. And so women, you know, without having to show their face or even their real name, you know, Minnie Mouse writes up, you know. And Minnie Mouse wants to say that her husband and she have, you know, kind of gotten lax in the sex department, and she wants to know which sex toys to start with. Now, you know that no one is going to ask that question if you know their name or can see their face. So what's great about the web is it's completely anonymous. And I'm learning so much. And Phil's having a wonderful time.
It's a win-win.
I love the web. It's a great place. And I came about doing the web. I'm talking too much, aren't I?
You go right ahead.
You ask me one question and
I'm completely...
You go
right ahead.
I've completely ignored this woman who's come out of her house to help me tonight, and I'm talking too much.
They are here to listen to you,
all right,
so
okay.
You go right ahead.
Gracious? I mean gracious, really. You are so gracious. I'm sure you've heard of this wonderful woman on NPR. I'm proud to be in her presence, even though I'm ignoring her completely. but anyway, what I was going to say is that when I was talking to groups like this, women every now and then in different cities would say, you know, there's no place for us on the web. There's no place for women over 40. I mean, it's all about Twitter and Lady Gaga and all this stuff that I could care less about. So just in a dialogue, because I've been talking to women ever since I did That Girl, I said, well, if there was a website, and believe me, I wasn't thinking of doing it. I mean, if I cut and pasted an email, I thought I was a genius, so I wasn't thinking anything about doing anything on the web. So I said, well, if there was a website for women over 40, what would you want on it? And they said, information. Information. And as the conversation went on, it's information, it's empowerment, it's motivation. How to start again, how to do it. How are people doing it? You know, what do? I'm 55 years old. I don't want to stop. I don't want to sit at home and knit for my grandchildren. I want to do something with the rest of my life. And what's fascinating is, unlike our grandparents, we're living a long time. And so if you're 50, you might have 40 years left. If you're 60, you could have 30 years left. You'd better have a second dream, or you're going to be really bored to death for the next 30 or 40 years. I mean, how much golf can you play, you know? So I got very excited about that, and I started going on my Facebook page. Well, I didn't really, but the people who worked for me did, because I wouldn't know how to get to my Facebook page. But we went on the Facebook page. I mean, let's be honest, you know. There's some things you can't start over about, and that's one of them. And so, went on my Facebook page and said, you know, is anybody out there have a story about how you started over after 40? And they started pouring in. Also, what started pouring in is women saying, how do you start over? You know, how do you even begin? And so that's how this book came about, because I thought this is a great, great topic and a great service for women. And I wanted this to be a book that wasn't a book that you read it and said, oh, isn't that interesting? These women did that. I wanted it to be a book that was a roadmap. If you read all the pieces, you'd say, oh, I see. So she did that, so I could do that. Oh, they did that. One of the things that I noticed is that many, many women did things differently. Some of them needed money to get started. So one woman gave up her apartment, slept on her friend's couch, sold all her designer clothes on eBay, and made some money and bought a little piece of a store so that she could sell these caramels that she had created and that she had. Another woman went back to school. Another woman joined up with her sister and created a company. All these women did different things. And one of the things that I learned from this interviewing these women that helped me is that you can think big, but you have to start small. You can want to change the world. You can want to become a doctor. You can want to own a restaurant. But let's say you want to own a restaurant. Let's say you make great food and everybody says, you know what? You should have a restaurant. So how do you have a restaurant? Well, you don't have a restaurant tomorrow. First, you got to figure out, okay, do I need to take a culinary class? Do I need to take a restaurant management class? Do I need to be an intern in a restaurant? You know, people love to pay you nothing to work, so you can always be an intern. You know, Do I make some of the foods that I make and just put them in a part of another store? Take, go to a store, a restaurant, a market or whatever, a bakery, and say, would you sell what I make and see how it goes? Because I have a friend who created something that I think is really interesting. I don't want to say what it is because she's still trying to get it sold. But it was for moms and grandmoms and women who take care of kids. And she took it to QVC, and they turned it down. And she was devastated. And I said, you're thinking too big. I mean, you've got to try it out. They call this in business the proof of concept. Make a prototype of your product and sell it at Gymboree or sell it at your local store. Sell it somewhere else. Should I get that for you? But don't think you're going to go to QVC right away. Try it out. Yeah. And I think that's one of the problems. We think that we have to go to the top of the mountain when, in fact, just go one step at a time. And if you did, if you have a goal, you have a dream that you want to make true, and you can't do it by yourself, so you do it with your sister or your mother or your son or your daughter, your husband, whoever you want to do it with. You do that, you get together or do it on your own, and you figure out some steps. And if you start doing one thing every day for the next 6 months, in 6 months, you'll be further along. That's what's really important, is to see the long road. And one of the things that I think is different about our generation, because we live longer, is that we're no longer looking back and saying, oh my God, I'm 50, I'm 60, I'm 70. We're saying, wait a minute, I've got 30 more years. Mm-hmm. I've got 40 more years. That's the difference.
Well,
and our grandmother...
I just want to jump in for a second. Because this is along the lines of what you're talking about.
So embarrassing.
No, no, no.
Go ahead, darling. What?
This is along... As I was listening, it occurred to me that one of the questions that has been batted around for so long is whether women can indeed have it all, right? I mean, you've heard this question for many years. In light of what you have seen in your own experience, in the experiences of the women that you've been writing about and talking with online, can women have it all?
Yes, they can have it all, but they're not going to have it all maybe at the same time. I think that's the difference for a lot of women. And it's, you know, I get asked all the time. In fact, just yesterday I was talking to a group of young women who came to interview me, college women who wanted to interview me for their women's studies class. And they were saying to me that they felt concerned that the boys in their classes still were treating them as if they weren't equal. And what did I think? You know, how was that going to change? And I said, nothing is going to change until the domestic arrangements change. That is the very basis of our lives. If you're going to get married and have a family, unless you and your partner are going to share the baby raising, then nothing changes. Because if the woman is always left holding the baby, then she's going to give up the years. And if she gives up the years and doesn't have a partner who gives up years too or gives up time too, then she will be left at 42 trying to figure out who she is and how she gets back in. When I interviewed Jill Abramson, who's the executive editor, as I said, of the New York Times, the first woman ever to have that very honorable, noble place. I think there's been 170 of them or something, and she's the only woman. And she said she could never have done it if she hadn't had the husband that she had. They have three children. And she said for a lot of the time, her husband had to carry the load, where she was an investigative reporter, and she would call him and say, you've got to pick the kids up at school. You've got to have a partner who's willing to say that it's his responsibility too. They're his children too. And unfortunately, that's not always true. And it's too late for us to change the domestic arrangements in our own lives if we're over 40. We're not going to change that. But for our children and our grandchildren, we need to pass down this idea that unless you have the right partner who's going to see your dream as important as his dream, then the culture will never change. I didn't marry until I was 40. And the reason, I mean, I was never going to marry. I had made that absolute blank thing. I mean, I didn't know I was going to go on a television show someday and meet some guy I wanted to marry, but I had decided I wasn't going to get married because I was a product of 10 Lebanese marriages. My father was one of 10, 9 boys and a girl. And there's nothing worse than a Lebanese man when it comes to domination. And my mother was one of 5, 4 girls and a boy. And there's also nothing worse than Italian men when it comes to domination. So that's all I saw were these dominated women marriages. And I thought, well, it's just not for me. It isn't what I want. I mean, I'm going to be an actress, and I'm going to travel the world, and I'm going to do all these things. And so I just decided that marriage wasn't for me because I saw marriage as an institution for 1.5 persons, where one person had a dream and the other person served that dream. And in my family, my father, there was a big pot called Dad's Dream, and everybody poured all of their love and ambition and everything into that pot. And then there are also many women who are stars, like Carol Burnett. Her husband produced her show. Mary Tyler Moore, her husband produced her show. So there are many women who were the one and the husband was the half. And I really didn't want that kind of marriage. I didn't want to be the half and I didn't want to marry a half. So I thought, well, then it's not for me. And so, you know, when I met Phil, he was divorced with 4 sons living with him and his daughter was living with his ex-wife. We were old enough to see that we each had a dream and that we were willing to stand aside and help the other one have their dream. I remember when we first got married, I was living in New York doing a play. My husband was living in Chicago doing the Donahue Show and raising 4 boys. And we were commuting on the weekends. And my aunt said, "That's not a marriage." And I thought, that's interesting, because to her it wasn't. But the only way I could be married is that the world had changed quite a bit since I was a girl and since my mom was a girl and gave up her singing career to get married. But marriage, we redefined marriage for ourselves. And we made marriage a roomier place where 2 whole persons could live. And that's why I was able to be married. But if the culture hadn't changed, I would still be what they used to call an old maid. And I'd be very happy, by the way.
A couple of questions on feminism. First of all, was it your upbringing that got you thinking about feminist ideas, or what was the genesis of that for you?
I think kind of what I was saying is that I saw how unfairly treated my aunts were. My dad was not a tyrant, but it was apparent, and he was not disrespectful to my mother, but it was apparent that he was the boss, and my mother had her own radio show when my mother and father met. In fact, my father was the announcer on my mother's radio show. But then my father was this very funny guy who was in little, you know, sort of Tinkertown kind of nightclubs in Detroit where they lived. And so he wanted to go to Chicago where the big clubs were. And so he asked my mother to marry him, and she adored him. He was the shiny object of her life. She worshipped him. And so she gave up her radio show, and she followed the love of her life to Chicago. And they started having children, and that was that. But later, she said to me, when I wasn't getting married all those years, she said to me, at first, when I wasn't getting married, she was hysterical. She was doing novenas and every other thing. About, you know, somewhere in my early 30s, she said to me, "You know what? I think you're right. I wish I had not given up my career. I love you kids, but I wish I hadn't given up my singing." That really, that honesty that she gave me meant so much to me. Because I realized that my mother had given up her whole life for us, and we really could have done it on half. We didn't need her whole life. And that breaks my heart. And when she died, I cried and cried for days. And my brother said to me, "Why are you so upset? Why are you taking this hard? I said, "I'm crying for her life. She didn't get to do what she wanted to do. So this book is about my mother, too. You know, we shouldn't give up what we want. We only live once. We should live out our dreams at any age. At any age. And if one woman in this room gets that from this book, I will feel so good. Because it really, that's where my feminism comes from. It comes from my mother. And I think most women, when you scratch them deep enough, their regrets, their dreams come from their mom. You know, we live with what our mothers didn't have, most of us, especially if we're older.
You mentioned work, and one of the big news stories this month has been about equal pay. Let's talk about that a little
still,
bit.
Still, imagine. Yeah. I mean, really. It used to be, what, 59 cents on a dollar, and now I think we've grown up 17 cents in about 30 years. It's amazing. No, it's insane, and I obviously, there's no reason why women should not get equal pay for the same job. How could that possibly be fair? Too bad we never passed the Equal Rights Amendment, but there you go. Let's not bring up old wounds, you know. No reason for that. But, you know, when I was about 16 years old, my father took me to Washington, D.C. for something to do with St. Jude, and he was very proud to take his 16-year-old daughter to go to the Senate Gallery. And so we stood up in the gallery to look down at all the senators. And I was only 16 years old. I didn't even know I was a feminist. And I turned to my father and I said, "Daddy, there aren't any women." My father looked a second time. "Yeah," he said, "they're not." They were all white guys with white shirts and ties walking around owning the world. And now there are 20 women. It's not enough, God knows, but at least it's 20, you know. I think there are now 19, 20 women CEOs of Fortune 500. The new woman who's the CEO of General Motors, I mean, that's a huge thing. A woman that's the head of the New York Times, that's a huge thing. But it's not enough. It's not enough. And enough women aren't running for political office. And I think if any woman in this room thinks that she might be a good public servant, you should go to your women friends and say, "Help me do this." And I think your women friends will help you. Because more and more women, you should be running for school boards, you should be running for head of departments in your communities. Just keep moving forward one step at a time until you become a woman, a congresswoman, or a mayor, or the governor, or the lieutenant governor. You all have it in you. There's nothing at all in your DNA that says you aren't every bit as equipped to be in the state legislature. Have you ever met any of the men in the state legislature? I spent a lot of time lobbying state legislators. And believe me, any one of you could be in the state legislature and do a great job.
Well, speaking of public office, Hillary in 2016, what do you think?
I hope so, God. Don't you? I mean, come on. Well, first of all, she'll get the nomination. They don't have anybody else but her, and she's so qualified. Is there ever been any candidate as qualified as she is? I mean, she was a great senator in New York. She's a who?
Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, Elizabeth Warren is fabulous. Next time. No, she's fabulous, Elizabeth Warren. I love her. Who doesn't love her? She's great. No, there's a lot of great women in this country. That's what I'm saying. There's so many great women. But, I mean, Hillary's been a great senator for New York. I'm from New York, and she was a great senator. She was a terrific Secretary of State. And that's one place that's been amazing. We've had three women Secretary of State, so that's amazing. But it's time, and I think she's our best shot at it.
I want to talk about Free to Be You and Me. Most everyone in our audience is familiar with that. And some years ago, the 35th anniversary edition came out. We were talking about it earlier. What is the secret to the longevity of that, the Free to Be franchise?
Well, Kurt Vonnegut wrote the afterword of the book. And he said, I've always felt that every child should be given a manual when they're born, as to how to cope on this planet and how to not fall off the planet and how to live on the planet. And we were very flattered that he wrote that for us. And it's true. And I think that's why it has remained, because it really is saying some very basic things, that you can be anything you want to be, that boys and girls should cooperate together and own the world, that we are part of a global community. It's not us against them, it's all of us. That mommies are people and daddies are people, that it's all right to cry, that William can have a doll, that Atalanta doesn't have to get married at the end of the story, my particular favorite, and a brunette princess, please note. It's non-sexist, non-racist, non-stereotype. And I think that every generation needs to know that. And I just want you to know, since we are here in this library, that I have to give a nod to libraries, because it was the librarians and the teachers of this country that made Free to Be You and Me a classic. It became a... It became a part of the curriculum in 35 states. You know, I was saying tonight at dinner that the first card I ever had in my little pink wallet when I was a girl was my library card. And, you know, I didn't have a Social Security card, and I certainly didn't have a credit card. I had my little $1.20 and my library card. And I was a very good library person. I always brought it back on time. And I was very excited at having that responsibility of being given a book that wasn't mine, that I could take home and read it, but I had to bring it back by that date. I was very responsible to that. I remember having my mom or dad or somebody drive me to the library so I could get my book back on time. So it's a great tradition for children. And of course, Nancy Drew was my hero. I wanted to be Nancy Drew when I grew up. And I think that girl was as close to Nancy Drew as you can get, actually. I hope they never come and sue me, because it really was Nancy Drew.
Although, probably not as glam as that.
Yeah, Nancy Drew never had that apartment.
How would you characterize the state of feminism now in America, or worldwide for that matter?
Well, you know, since we still don't have equal pay, and we only have 20 women in the Senate, and we've never had a woman president, though there are more women leaders all around the country. I mean, we're kind of late on that. I think there's about 20 or 21 women leaders of other countries. I think, you know, we're not there, but we're further along. I mean, when I grew up, there weren't any women in the Senate, and there were no women anchoring the news. I mean, now on CNN and cable, they're all women. They wear a little bit too much lip gloss, but there are women. I'd like to do a little makeover on most of them. But still, they're there. You know, they're there. And it makes me very happy to know that my nieces and nephews and my grandnieces and my grandnephews are seeing women in important positions. You know, when I went to doctors and dentists, they were all men. My husband and I we needed a new doctor in New York, and a friend of ours recommended a woman doctor, and we went to meet her, and we both now go to her. She's our internist, and it's not because she's a woman, it's because she seemed the best of the people that we talked to. That's very exciting. I mean, I never met a woman doctor when I was a kid. I never met a woman anything when I was a kid. So, I mean, so much has changed. We can't lose sight of that. A lot has changed. What is feminism today? Feminism today is what we pass on. If we don't pass it on, it's like anything else. It's like democracy. Democracy is not a right. Democracy is something we created. It's our privilege, and we have to stoke it all the time. And there are those who will chip away at our democratic rights, and we must always be very vigilant about our rights. And it's the same with the women's rights and the women's movement and civil rights and gay rights and all human rights. We have to continually stoke them and be vigilant about them. We are the lieutenants. We are the protectors of our rights. Nothing is handed to us. Nothing is a privilege. Everything is a well-fought-for right.
I just have one more question for Marlo, and then we'll open it up for your questions. So hopefully you've thought of some, or you might have a comment to make, but we'll take your questions in just a moment. Marlo, catch us up on St. Jude's and what's happening there these days.
Oh, that's such a big question. as you probably know, my father passed away 22 years ago, which is hard to believe, but it was 22 years ago. The loveliest man that ever lived, my father, my daddy. He was a great guy. Really a good, loving man. 1 year of high school, and he created the leading research center for pediatric cancer in the world. It's amazing that he could do that. Thank you. So if any of you sitting here, male or female, wonder what kind of difference you can make in the world, oh my God, what a difference every single one person can make. But St. Jude is great, is doing great. Where should I start? Well, the biggest thing that's happening right now in science is the genome. We've invested about $95 million in our genome project, and we now have the map of 700 children. We have 700 children's genome maps, which is more than anybody in the world. The closest any other research center has ever had is 10. So we are studying 700 genome maps of children. So we're seeing which markers, why does a good blood cell become a leukemia cell? Why does a good brain cell become a tumor cell? You know, what is happening? And we can only see that by studying all those genomes. Because we're a research center, we have in our vault underneath the hospital the tissue of all the children who've ever come to St. Jude since 62. So our scientists are still studying the tissue of children who died 50 years ago. And that tissue is being researched and studied against the tissue of these 700 children and the other children that are also there at St. Jude. So we are constantly studying, and we study every child who comes to St. Jude. They are studied until the day they die. We have patient 17 who's in his 60s. Who comes back every year, because what we want to know is, what did our treatment do to you? And of course, patient 17 has a lot more problems from radiation and chemo than the child who was cured 3 years ago. And what we've learned from these children, the ones that did survive, is, were they able to have children? How's their hearing? How's their eyesight? How's their liver? Did they get another cancer? Because often you get another cancer from chemo and radiation. So we study all of the things, and little by little we have perfected. In leukemia, for example, Dr. Pooey, who's the leading leukemia doctor scientist in the world, if you ever put in childhood leukemia, Dr. Pooey's name will come up. P-U-I is a brilliant doctor/researcher. Been with St. Jude for 35 years. He, 5 years ago, decided no more radiation for our leukemia patients, which was very, very controversial, and many of the hospitals did not want to follow. I don't know how many actually follow now. I should really find that out. But he decided no more, that our chemo was now so customized and so precise that we could spare the children the ravages of radiation. So we've done very, very well with that. And we've just are opening our own proton beam, the first proton beam ever for children in the world will be at St. Jude, another $100 million investment. So one of the reasons why I may look as tired as I do, I spend a lot of time raising the $850 million a year that it takes to keep all these programs going. In 2008, when the world went to hell, we had a big phone call of our 45 board members on the phone as to what we were going to do. Do we cut programs? Do we cut children? What do we do? And so everybody was talking, and the scientists were talking, and the doctors were talking, and we were talking, the board members were talking. What do we do? What do we cut? And by the end of the conversation, we decided we couldn't cut anything. We couldn't cut programs. We were not going to stop any scientists from moving forward. We couldn't cut the kids. We're not going to turn away any more kids. We're not going to send kids out that are already there. We had only one choice. We had to raise more money, and we do. And that's what you help us do. So thank you for that. But I just say one thing.
Sure. One more thing.
I just would like to say one thing. There are a group of women here tonight who've come and who really own a piece of my heart. They're the network group. Are you all here? Whoever's in the network, the transition network group of women, would you stand up? I want everybody to see you. These are women who are living the new dream. Here they are. Look at them. These women belong to an organization. They just got in touch with me a couple of weeks ago, and I was very excited. I didn't even know they existed. I think the first chapter was in New York, right? It was founded by two women who were in their 50s and said to each other, we're retired, what are we going to do next? And so they created this group called the Transition Network, who are looking for what they're going to do next. They're supporting each other in that. They're talking to each other. That's always been the strength of the women's movement, is that we share our pain, we share our solutions, we share each other's interests, and we support each other to move on to the next thing. So I'm very excited. I met them earlier tonight, and I've told every one of them, if they don't buy my book, then no one will. So they're responsible.
Well, on that note, it's your turn. We've got some ladies with microphones, so if you would just raise your hand, just signal to us, and we'll get one of those microphones to you, and it's your turn to ask questions. All right, I see someone back there.
Hi, Marlo. Welcome to Philadelphia. My name's Camille Zogby, and I come from a huge Lebanese family.
I bet you're one of my cousins. Are you going to tell me you're my cousin? I've never met a Lebanese person who didn't say they were my cousin. Are you my cousin? Tell me the truth.
We're related.
What did he say?
He said, we're related.
In any event, I want to just preface this with...
You're going to try to tell me that Lebanese men aren't domineering?
Well, that's a part of my question. But when I was a child, my grandfather had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and as young people always are, they're interested in gadgets. So he only had one tape on this, and it was a tape of your dad giving a speech at a fundraiser in Utica, New York. My grandfather, Khalil Zogby, was the Toastmaster who introduced him. So we all loved Danny Thomas, and our grandfather introduced him, so we were really proud. But my question is, in my family, the women are pretty much feared. They're really... Lebanese women are very, very strong women, and they generally, in my family, didn't let anybody push them around. And they're very accomplished women. And I guess, do you think that growing up in that with that kind of heritage had any effect on you as a woman?
Well, as I say, I grew up where the men did dominate the women. And let me say this, they didn't marry Lebanese women. So they... that probably is the problem. And the difference. I will tell you this, and this is kind of personal, but I remember when my aunts and uncles used to fight, no matter how angry my aunt would get, their husband would say, where's she going to go? And I took that as my mantra. I was going to have a place to go. Nobody was ever going to say to me, where is she going to go? And that really, I mean, that was a muscle. You know, it really was. By the time I met Phil, when Phil and I first started dating, and I had told him I was never getting married. On his show, I talked about it. And he asked me to marry him. And I said, you're not listening. I'm never getting married. And I was never going to get married because it frightened me. I mean, I thought, woo. I had two things. When we got married, Gloria Steinem and Bella Abza gave me a bridal shower. Can you imagine? And they hung around the room all of the things I had said about marriage all those years. And it was really, it was like visiting, you know, the House of Horrors. You know, looking. One of them was, marriage is like living with a jailer you have to please. And the one that was really great was, marriage is like a vacuum cleaner. You stick it to your ear and it sucks out all your energy and ambition. So you can imagine why I never got married. I mean, you know, so that was my feeling about marriage. So, you know, when Phil first asked me to marry him, I thought, I said, look, we get along, we have fun, we travel. This is great. What do we need marriage for? So he said, okay, you know, fine. And by the way, I was a bridesmaid 17 times. The year I graduated from college, all of my girlfriends got married to men I'd hardly met. They were, you know, you've got to get married, you graduate from college. So, I mean, I got pinned in college because that's what everybody did. And it was romantic and all that. And I wanted to have one of those little pins, but I wasn't going to get married. The minute I graduated from college, I was off to New York to study acting. But anyway, so they were all getting married. So I thought, well, you know, so I bought my own house. I got my own silver pattern, my own china pattern, my own crystal pattern. I mean, I was my own husband, you know. I didn't need a husband to have a silver pattern. I did it all by myself. And that was it. I was perfectly happy. I had wonderful dinner parties. I had wonderful boyfriends. Lovely boyfriends. In fact, I met a man tonight named Leonard Goldberger. I had a boyfriend named Leonard Goldberg. Lovely guy. Nice Lebanese girl, nice Jewish boy. Terrific. But, in fact, I only dated Jewish boys my whole life because I grew up in Beverly Hills, which you might as well be a shtetl, check it. And then I married this Irishman, which was so weird. But anyway, why am I saying all this? Go on. What was it? I had a glass of wine at dinner, and I'm completely zonked. I'm the cheapest drunk you'll ever meet.
There's a gentleman over here with a question. Let's go over here.
A long time ago, you gave an interview about how that girl came to be and how you had to sell it. Would you remind this audience how that happened? I mean, because she was groundbreaking in her day.
Well, thank you. I don't want to take forever to tell the story, but I had done a pilot. You all know what a television pilot is. And I had done a pilot called Two's Company. One less. You know, one more we'd have made it, maybe. But anyway, and I screen tested for it. Four Blondes and Me. I thought I'll never get it, but I got it. And it was a very good pilot and didn't sell, which is... You know, most pilots don't sell. But the head of the network, a man named Edgar Scherer, called me in and said, this didn't sell, but we believe that you could be a television star. And Clairol would like to sponsor a show starring you. Because Clairol was looking for a young woman to sell shampoo with. You know, it's an advertising medium, as you know. So I said, great, you know, wonderful, wow, you know, how exciting. So he sent me a bunch of scripts, and I called him up. And I said, could I come in and see you? And he said, sure. And I came in and I said, look, everything you're giving me to read, the girl is either the wife of somebody or the secretary of somebody or the daughter of somebody. Have you ever thought about doing a show where the girl is the somebody? And he said, would anybody watch a show like that? And I said, well, I'm going to give you this book. It's called The Feminine Mystique. I swear to God. I said, just read this and call me, because I really think that this is where it's going. It's not that we're not our mother's daughters. It's a whole other breed now. So, and he was an older man, you know, he looked at me, you know. So he called me about a couple weeks later, and he read it. And he said to me, okay, I read your book. Like, it wasn't my book, it was Betty Friedan's book. I read your book. Is this going to happen to my wife? And here's the funny thing. It did. His wife left him for a jazz musician. I swear to God. But not that moment, thank God, or I never would have had this show. But anyway, he gambled on it. And all the research said that it would not be a success, that the audience of America did not like single women who weren't in a family unit. They did not care about show business. And who ever heard of somebody named Marlo Thomas? So the whole thing was not going to be a success. They promoted it a lot. And the first night we went on the air, we got a 40 share, which is unheard of today because there are too many channels. But it was we killed everybody. And the reason is that, as this gentleman just said, there weren't any other single girls on television, single working girls not living at home who wanted to be independent. That had never happened before. The only single women were like Eve Arden and Miss Brooks, and they were called spinsters. But there was not a young, vibrant young woman ever on television. And the interesting thing is that the researchers were wrong. She wasn't really that revolutionary. She was a fait accompli. Every home in America had a That Girl in it. To this day, I go on the street. Even the woman who's the editor of the New York Times said to me when she was growing up, That Girl was her hero. That she wanted to be That Girl, you know? I mean, there was Nancy Drew, and then there was Anne Marie. And I'm thrilled and flattered that that happened. But and That Girl is what really turned me into a feminist. I had my feminist feelings, or I never would have said I was never going to get married. I would have never wanted to do a show like That Girl. But the mail that came in from That Girl was stunning. I received letters from girls who were 16 years old. I'm 16 years old and I'm pregnant. I can't tell my father. Where can I go? I'm 23 years old. I'm married with two children. My husband beats me up. Where can I go? And I was flabbergasted. This is 1966, 67, 68. My secretaries and I, we called them secretaries then, we looked up where somebody could go in these different cities, and there wasn't any place for them to go. There was no place to go for legal counsel. There was no place to go for safety. There was no place to go for reproductive information. No place. That politicized me. That made me not just a feminist. It made me a radical feminist. I wanted to change the world for women and girls to have a place to go when they were in trouble. And that's what the women's movement has done, and I'm proud to say I'm a feminist, and I will always be a feminist. Yeah. And I have two young women in the audience here. How old are you? 17. And what?
16.
Mm-hmm. Are you listening to me? You're the only people I'm talking to.
We have time for one last question. One last question. There's a lady right here. Yep.
What made you finally decide to get married? Because when I was young and watching your show, I bought a fall so I can have a flip like you. I brought my picture to show you. And then I also said, I am not going to get married. I want to travel the world and do everything. And waited until I was 53 and married my husband. And I married my best friend. What made you decide to get married?
The same old-fashioned way. I fell in love with somebody. There isn't any other reason to be married as far as I'm concerned. Phil and I were going together for about 3 years. He'd asked me to marry him twice, and I had said no twice. And after about 3 years, it just became apparent that this is who I wanted to be with, and that we lived in two different cities. We both wanted to put our lives together. And when we decided to get married, he said to me, well, one of us has to move. And I said, well, I can work in two cities. I can work in L.A. and I can work in New York. And he said, I can work in New York or I can work in Washington. He said, I can't work in L.A. I don't want to interview Burt Reynolds for the rest of my life. So we said, okay, well, then let's move to New York. Because I was actually living in L.A. most of the time. So he moved his show to New York. We waited till his last son had graduated high school. And he moved the show to New York, and I moved to New York. And we got an apartment, and I remember we went on 60 Minutes. And Mike Wallace said to me, well, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but it seems to me that it's the woman who moves for the man. The man doesn't move for the woman. And I said, oh, Mike, you're not old-fashioned, you're Neanderthal. But here's the good part. He left it in. It's in. If you go to the 60 Minutes whatever archive, it's in there. I always loved Mike Wallace for that. He left it in. I mean, I smashed him, and he left it in. Call somebody Neanderthal, and they leave it in. That's good. That was very good. Make now, sure I would like to know if one of these young women has a question.
Sure.
Do you have a question? Now, I'm sorry to put you on the spot. But I just wonder, is there something you're wondering about in your own lives or at your school that you're seeing that you're worried about with the girls and the boys and all that? It's all working perfectly? I don't have to worry about you? You're going to get what you want out of life? Huh? They're fine. All right. Well, listen, it's been great. I've really enjoyed myself. You're terrific and kind and nice and... I mean, really, I've only had one glass of wine, but I've had a wonderful time. And you're so sweet, all of you. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.